Okay, so welcome back to the last session of the conference. So this is a panel in English on the international monetary and financial system. So it's a great honor to have these wonderful three panelists around me. Of course, I'm not going to spend any time talking. Is it better? It's better. So. It's a great honor to have these three panelists around me to discuss the future of the international monetary and financial system. I'm not going to spend any time discussing the life achievements of these three persons. It would be too long. I just want to say that, so we have on my right, Gita, who is now the first deputy manager of the IMF and a co-author of Emmanuel. We have here on my left, Jean Tirole, Nobel Prize in Economics, and a co-author of Emmanuel. And we have here Jean-Charles Rocher, professor in Geneva, and not, as far as I know, a co-author of Emmanuel. So we are going to discuss these important issues related to the international monetary system, and I just wanted to start the panel by actually quoting from an interview that Emmanuel gave at the Richmond Fed in 2019, because he was asked precisely about the international monetary system. And he said, "There is very little academic work on the topic today. There is a general notion that the concept is a bit amorphous. Many economists also seem to believe that these questions are not so important anymore. Maybe it mattered back when we had the gold standard and things like that. But these are remnants of the past, and we have graduated from them. I think it's a big mistake. The international monetary system played a major role in history, and it remains important today. Just think about the role of the gold exchange standard in propagating the Great Depression. Think about the end of Bretton Woods, the advent of flexible exchange rates, the liberalization of capital accounts, the explosion of capital flows. There are a lot of very pressing policy questions that pertain to the international monetary system and its workings nowadays." So that's just the perfect, I think, introduction for Gita. Pressing policy questions. We have seen amazing shocks to the world economy. We have seen the COVID shock. We have seen the war in Ukraine, major disruptions in trade, in capital flows, emerging markets being very stressed, liquidity being withdrawn from all the major central banks except the Bank of Japan. So how can we describe this current situation of stress of the international monetary and financial system?
Okay, so thanks Hélène. And indeed that was a great quote you read from Emmanuel. So on the question of the international monetary system, I'm going to make three kind of buckets of points. The first is about how the system functioned, or basically what was unique about the functioning of what happened with capital flows and with exchange rates during the pandemic, so 2020 and 2021. The second is about where we are now, and which is the current context you described, with a completely different environment, and what does that imply for the functioning of the international monetary system? And now, on top of the pandemic, you have the war and what the consequences are of it. And third is on the new kinds of money that we have, different forms of digital money, different kinds of assets, cryptocurrencies, central bank digital currencies, and what, at least in policy circles, are being discussed as the main concerns or main issues to be dealt with over here. So I speak for about 10 minutes, is that what you said? Yeah. Okay. Okay. I have my timer on too. Okay, so on the first broad topic of what happened during the pandemic year, 2020 and 2021, firstly, 2020 was, as everybody knows, the worst peacetime recession since the Great Depression. The global economy shrank by around 3%. as a useful benchmark, you can think of the global financial crisis when that number was negative 0.1%. So global growth was negative 0.1%, while during the peak of the pandemic, 2020, it was around minus 3%. But what was really surprising, I guess, if you had ex ante said that you would have a state of the world where the global economy would shrink by 3%, you probably would have thought a financial crisis would have gone along with it. But there was no global financial crisis, right? And yes, there was a brief period at the start of the pandemic, around March 2020, when you saw a rapid reversal of capital flows to emerging markets and borrowing costs going up. But that reversed itself very, very quickly. So why was that? Two reasons, I guess. One probably more important than the second. But the first reason is the extraordinary amount of policy support that was provided in this pandemic crisis. So you had central banks around the world, basically, you know, everybody in a synchronized fashion cut interest rates, did all kinds of liquidity injections. And there was a large amount of fiscal policy support, especially in the advanced world, to keep the economy in some sort of a hibernation state where its balance sheets would stay, you know, would remain as they are, and so that once you open up, you would get a very fast recovery. I mean, that was the thinking for policy. So that was an important part of it, why we didn't end up with a global financial crisis. And the second part, of course, was that there were lessons learned, and there was the fact that after the GFC, there were regulatory improvements that happened, especially with the financial sector, with the banking sector, that actually did make banks more resilient, and therefore you also didn't have the crisis that would have otherwise happened. So that was a year, 2020 was a year when hard currency flows to emerging markets was at a record. So it was like $200 billion. That was a record. Again, you would never have predicted that ex ante while these economies went in deep recession at the same time. They received a large amount of capital flows. 2021 was another record year, so it was second to 2020, but so it was a bit short, it was 175 billion. So that's the first thing. So what did that mean in terms of the global financial safety net, which is a part of the international monetary system, is that if you look at the countries coming to the IMF for financing, there was hardly any emerging major middle-income country or emerging market that needed financing help or balance of payments help during this period. The IMF provided funding to about 83 countries. It was emergency financing, but they were mainly low middle-income countries. This was nothing like a financial crisis. So it was basically the central banks around the world, especially the major ones, the Fed, and the swap lines they provided to some, that basically prevented a crisis from happening. The regional global financial safety nets, like the European Stability Mechanism, the Chiang Mai Initiative, and so on, also, no, there was hardly any money taken from any of these institutions. So that's the first thing that was quite remarkable. So there was no flight to safety, the kind of typical phenomenon that you see. In fact, another unique marker of this period was that the dollar barely moved relative to its trading partners. So usually in any crisis, you would have the dollar would appreciate relative to its basket of currencies, including, you know, its main trading partners, relative to emerging markets and so on. But that was not the case. So in fact, the dollar barely moved. There was hardly any movement in the exchange. So this was a combination, again, of the Fed being incredibly aggressive in cutting rates and so on. So that's the first feature of it. So in one sense, I guess there was something learned from the GFC that was very valuable. Now moving on to now, which is where we are right now. We're in a completely different place with record high levels of debt in most countries of the world. Emerging markets, if you want, as a comparison, the last Fed tightening cycle you know, when the taper tantrum started around 2013, their debt to GDP was around, the median emerging market debt to GDP was around 40%. Now that number is 60%. Of course, there are compositional differences in the currencies in which they hold. They have much higher reserves than they did back then. So the important difference is there. But we're now heading to a world where pre-pandemic borrowing costs for emerging markets were about 4%, looking at the emerging market bond index. Now that, I haven't checked the number today, but yesterday that number was 8%. The borrowing costs have gone up quite substantially. And debt levels are high. So coming back to the international monetary system, I think there is the one big hole in the international monetary system or the international financial architecture, which is the whole debt resolution mechanism. How do you restructure debt? So this is work that we've all worked out. Emmanuel has also written papers on sovereign debt with Manuel and Mark and me. And it's basically the, you know, how do we end up, how the unique feature of sovereigns is that they don't have a resolution mechanism. They don't have a bankruptcy mechanism. And so because of that, you need to come up with other forms of, set up other kinds of frameworks to be able to resolve their debt. And the world is particularly complicated, unlike before, when you had most of the lenders to emerging and developing economies were Paris Club creditors, which is basically Europe and US. But now the credit landscape is very different. For most of the countries, especially for the developing countries, China is a major creditor, and private creditors are also, it's not part of the Paris Club. And you have the private creditors also that are play a very much bigger role. So what did the what was the response from the all the discussions that have happened in the G20 and G7 and every place was they came up with, as you might have heard of, the so-called common framework. So the common framework is basically the new the new debt resolution mechanism. This is supposed to fill the hole in the international financial architecture, which is a way to bring together, put everybody in a level playing field, all official creditors and private creditors, for the first time to be able to get to have resolution. Three countries approached the G20 common framework to see whether they could resolve their debt. It's been over a year now, and unfortunately the system hasn't delivered yet. So Chad was the first country that came, but that resolution hasn't happened yet, and it's incredibly complicated. It's one of the parts of my job that I spend a lot of time on. But again, so this is again a part of the whole architecture that we certainly need more work on. It is incredible how state contingent debt instruments are still very difficult to get either official creditors or private sector to accept, because now would be a good time to put those kinds of, especially for instance in response to a pandemic or in response to earthquakes and so on, natural disasters, how do you respond, right? So that's another big area. So there's a hole that needs to be filled there. And also there's long discussions about which countries get covered by the common framework. Right now it's only mostly low-income countries, but then you have countries like Sri Lanka that are now in trouble, and so there's help for them too. So that's another big area. Again, in terms of now, a big issue on the international monetary system was triggered by the war, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and also importantly by the sanctions. So the fact that certain Russian banks were excluded from the SWIFT payment system, the freeze on central bank reserves, Russia's central bank reserves, these are all major events in the history of the international monetary system. So this is also leading to big questions about whether now we will have a decoupling of payment systems around the world. By the way, that is also something that preceded the pandemic, so it's not preceded the war. It wasn't only triggered by the war. But there is the concern of whether there will be, you know, Western bloc and payment systems with the Western bloc and a China bloc and a bunch of emerging markets who are non-aligned to try to figure out which bloc to be a part of. So that's one big issue. Secondly, of course, there is also the question of central bank reserves and whether now this has implications for dollar dominance. I think the bottom line is that given that to be a dominant currency, you have to have very strong institutions and you need to have very deep financial markets, full convertibility of your current account and your capital account. It's hard to think of, for instance, countries like China being able to make a big dent very quickly. But these are questions that have come up. And another big issue, which I guess is broader than the international monetary system, is the resilience of global supply chains. That's a topic of a lot of discussion these days. My last little piece I'll talk about is on crypto and CBDC, just very quickly. You know, the question is, can we tell how big a deal this is going to be for the international monetary system? I think there's the sense is that there's terrible uncertainty at this point, and especially in the current context when you've seen the valuation of crypto assets go from 2.3 trillion to like 1.1 trillion or so right now. So massive movements. What's obviously clear is that these crypto assets don't provide any form of hedge. I mean, they move perfectly with the stock market, so there's no, it's not as if you get any hedging benefit from holding these crypto assets. What is true is that there is, again, this is another hole in the international financial architecture that where a lot of work is happening, which is on what kind of regulation to do to be able to, you know, deal with the risks of these different forms of crypto assets and digital monies. It doesn't exist. This is also work in progress, so this is going to be another big reform agenda. I mean, the reasons you need it is because an individual country really can't deal with it. It's not as if a single emerging market can decide that we have all the rules in place to avoid it, because all of this can be done very easily. It's borderless. You can have accounts anywhere in the world and deal in this. Right? So that's a big issue. And of course, there are some countries like El Salvador which have decided that they're going to make Bitcoin official tender, right, which is something completely would view as the wrong thing to do. So this is another big area where a lot of work is happening. It's again unclear whether how big of a dent this will have on the international monetary system. Developing countries are quite concerned about currency substitution that can happen at home. When people going into these cryptocurrencies. They are concerned about the effectiveness of their monetary policy in that state of the world. They're concerned about the capital flow, whether the capital controls will work. So again, this is a big area to do work on. So again, just to summarize, in terms of the, I think if I look at the questions, the big issues on my table, the one is on the whole debt resolution framework. The other one is on the resilience of global supply chains and fragmentation. There's a very big concern that we are, you know, there's all the words of onshoring, friendshoring, nearshoring, and the implications of all of that for global trade. And big issues on these new forms of crypto assets and so on, and how to regulate them. Okay, I will stop with that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Geeta. It was extremely clear and rich. So we will rebound, I hope, if time permits, on several of the points you touched upon. But we are going to go from exactly where you left it to now Jean Tirole, who is going to discuss a bit more, I understand, about cryptos and CBDCs and maybe venture a tiny bit into geopolitics.
Okay. I'll try. Thank you, Ellen. Yes, I'm going to discuss a little bit currency wars, the kind of war that we're going to witness between cryptocurrencies, private money, digital money, and also CBDC. So I think before talking about this war, you first have to talk about the market. What is a market? And it seems there are multiple markets. There's one, the market for a store of value, speculation, I would say. Not a safe store of value, because clearly Bitcoin is like gold. It's not really a completely safe store of value, but But then there is the issue about whether it could be for transactions as well, so it's a different ball game. So let me start with private money and cryptocurrencies. The demand and supply side are pretty clear, I would say. On the demand side, the users want low transaction costs. I mean, of course, that's not going to work for cryptocurrencies, but if you think about the digital renminbi nowadays, it's, you know, the transaction cost of is 0.1%, whereas credit cards, debit cards were 2% at least. So they can be a saving, so there's demand there. Financial inclusion, of course, we also want that for cross-border payments. In some countries, you want to escape a dysfunctional monetary system. If you are in Venezuela, for example, that's clear. But of course, you know, there is a reason, the usual reasons about tax evasion, money laundering, terrorism, and the like. And also the ideology, the libertarian, which I never understood, but you know, it's something that that is important on the demand side. And on the supply side, the entrepreneurs, their goal is pretty clear, is to make money, senior age of new coin and having intermediation fees, and also some indirect benefits. You can collect data and you can lock in consumers if you're Amazon and, or Facebook and so on. So we understand pretty well what the demand side and supply side are. They still face a huge number of challenges, as we all know. So far, as I said, you know, they are basically speculative instruments. I mean, they are nowhere near transaction instruments, by and large. They are still very expensive and slow. They lack a two-sided platform business. I mean, sitting next to Jean-Charles, we can talk about two-sided platforms, but you need to attract buyers and sellers if you want to engage in transactions. And then there is a price stability, which is huge. That's why actually they start having stable coins, trying to have enough collateral actually to back those cryptocurrencies. Even that has challenges because, of course, you really have to have a prudential regulator which is going to do that to make sure that there is no risk-taking. And maybe the first year or two, it's okay. But you know, after a while, they will be very tempted to speculate with the money. And if they lose the money, that's a big issue for the users. So you need, it's just something which strikes me really is that people are completely confused between technology and fundamentals. You change the technology, it's great. The fundamentals haven't changed. And that's true for fintech more generally. But for cryptocurrency, you do need, if you have stable coins, to have a prudential regulator. And that raises the question of who it should be, because you have a regulator who wants to attract activity on the soil, and then is really something which is, you know, by essence global. So that's really an issue. Who is going to be the lender of last resort in case of a run and so on. Now, honestly, I'm not a big fan, and I'm not sure many people around this table will be a big fan of cryptocurrency. I mean, actually, I'm shocked that there is no more action by governments to stop this whole thing. Not only because it's used for terrorism and money laundering and tax evasion and blah, 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 but there is also the loss of seniorage. It's either wasted, you know, the competition to mint coins. It's privatized. There's a challenge, and Gita talked about it, there's a challenge for financial stability, for running counter-cyclical monetary policy. And then, you know, if the fragile, what Emmanuel and I call the fragile people, you know, the SMEs, the depositors, and the financial intermediaries also invest in bitcoins, it's pretty clear that there will be bailouts. I mean, and that goes back to the architecture of the financial system. You know, we know that regulation goes hand in hand with state insurance services like bailouts, land of last resort deposit insurance, the like, and you know, it's not going to be an exception. And this is really shadow; it's really in the shadow. And then you have to take out of the system quite fast or insulate the fragile players from those things. Now, it's still the case that the central banks have been pretty slow at reacting to this phenomenon and creating their own digital money. We have some in China, for example, but Even so, they really have a comparative advantage because, I mean, not in all dimensions, but at least in two, which is that a state can decide what is a legal tender, and it can decide what you pay your taxes, in which currency you pay your taxes. There are some benefits, of course, comparative advantage of a state. I think the state has to do like what was done in Brazil with PIX, to compel the financial institutions and fintech to join the platform. It's actually, that's, I understand, I believe that's what the Chinese have done as well. Now, who is going to have access to CBDC, the public digital money? The current projects are, at least in China, but also, you know, there was a report 2 years ago by seven major central banks together with the BIS, I believe, basically saying, well, we're going to leave that to deposits, basically, to standard deposits. The People's Bank of China was very clear, the new digital currency is not meant to replace deposits held in bank accounts and balances held by payment apps such as Alipay and WeChat. Now, you might think you might extend beyond that, and that I haven't seen many good discussions of that, and I would like to basically suggest that people in this room do research on that. We should remember that deposits, by the way, are not all meant to be safe. Of course, you know, they are the insurance deposits, which are insured by the state de facto as a lender of last resort and through deposit insurance. But in normal times, the deposits are actually covered by the loans, and we are not sure that we want narrow banking. But also, the deposits are not meant to be short-term necessarily. I mean, some of them have to be, but they don't have to be demandable. And you know, actually, one of the functions of banks is actually to transform, to perform the transformation function. So the question is, how do you define your CBDC? Is that going to be just a substitution for current deposits? It's just you are changing the technology, you're making transactions cheaper, but you still go through banks, basically. It's just, and then you could say there is a limit of $50,000 or $100,000 for that per person on those things. That will be the easiest things to do. If we go beyond that, the question is, you know, who is going to have access to those safe, demandable deposits, and you know, that's an issue. Unless basically you start having the central bank and the government do what banks do now, you know, basically have a split between deposits and other claim on the banks, and of course on the other side of the balance sheet to do the loans, which I would not trust exactly the banks, the government to do. Let me conclude with, so I don't have an answer to that question, I'm just raising the question for you and hoping you're going to solve it for me. Just a couple of quick remarks, and I'm not an expert, but on dollar dominance and the war to be a reserve currency. Now, in the past, the dollar ticked all the right boxes, in a sense, for currency adoption. And of course, it's still very dominant. It's at least 60% for reserve, but you have different numbers for transactions and so on. And yeah, the boxes were clear. Gita mentioned the deep financial markets, the existence of safe assets. And of course, that goes back to the work of Emmanuel with Pierre-Olivier and Hélène, and also with Matteo. The U.S. was actually quite good also in terms and was willing to supply liquidity. And of course, you know, we saw the swap lines in 2008, the fiscal bailout. And of course, the U.S. has always kept room for maneuver, fiscal room for maneuver. So that actually, and that's you know, that's important because we go back again to Pierre-Olivier and Hélène's work on the exorbitant privilege, and also the work I still almost completed with Emmanuel on this issue. It had, and that was mentioned already, it, you know, the U.S. is a trusted state, a state of law with property rights, with an electorate which is pro-financial for various reasons, welcoming to foreign investment. unlikely to confiscate or freeze assets, so there was no dollar weaponization. It's linked with another thing, by the way, which is that if you look at who were the big economic powers, they were all political allies. And that has changed, of course. China, of course, is just one example. So, you know, the economic power is more now more widespread compared to earlier. Before, they were mainly in the hands of allies of the U.S. But, you know, if you look at all those boxes, you know, there have been some changes lately. The increase in debt in the U.S., Trump, then, you know, all the rise of China, Russia, the way that U.S. is using SWIFT for sanctions, and, you know, more recently the sanction, even so they are fully justified against Russia and so on. So there's this question about whether the dollar is going to be as attractive in the future to at least people who have the money in the world. Now, is it going to be the end of the dollar dominance? And I think, Gita, you were kind of reluctant to say that. And I think somehow you are right. And for one thing, I mean, there is inertia. I mean, your work with Jeremy, for example, is on strategy on complementarities. But of course, you know, you can say it's multiple criteria, but it's also inertia, a very slow process of adjustment to news. And also the fact, then the second point, is that the rivals are not quite ready yet. So starting with Europe, the Eurozone is doing decently, but you know, we have had a Eurozone crisis, which is not quite over because we are well indebted. We have no swap lines. We have relatively few safe assets. And as for China, well, it's not completely trustworthy. In particular due to the surveillance system, but also the financial markets are not completely open. And we had some papers this afternoon about that. The property rights are still uncertain, geopolitical ambitions. So it's hard. I mean, you know, one possibility, I will not see the dollar disappearing at all. I mean, I don't know. You know, the honest answer is I just don't know. But, you know, the fact is that we are entering a Cold War. I hope not, but it's a possibility. And in that case, we could have a multipolar world with, you know, basically regimes which trust with each other, and then a few dominant currencies. And finally, another question I don't have an answer to that you know, is a difficult choice between, and that has nothing to do with the dominance, but I put it on the table. Between controlling the transactions, you know, if you have a digital currency, it becomes really easy to control the transaction. That's what the ECB wants to do. In my view, that's the right way. But, you know, when you see what's going on in China, you know, you start thinking twice also. And given that our regimes are not fully trustworthy, and given all the populist movement, illiberal democracies around, we don't know. So I don't know what the answer is to that question. And it's certainly, you know, the Chinese digital currency is not just for efficiency. It's certainly is helping with efficiency. There's no doubt about that, and it's very useful, but it's not the only purpose. And that's something we also have to think about. So I'm still in the, you know, in the camp of centralization and having the state do everything, but, you know, sometimes I'm nervous about my own position.
Well, thanks a lot for these wise words. I think from the two interventions, maybe if we can come back briefly a little bit later about this idea that given that in a way the last time we had a transition from one international currency to the other, it was sterling and the dollar, and they were indeed allies. It was a very different situation from a geopolitical point of view from this time around, if we believe indeed there's going to be some disruptions, and whether this makes it more likely maybe that some functions of international currencies may become a bit more unbundled. So you were talking about the decoupling of the international payment system, which can be used you know, in a geopolitical way. So whether that makes it more likely, indeed, that things like that may happen also because of a technological change, we can think of other issues like swap lines to a favorite set of countries, which also can happen. We can think about trade credit being given also to subset of countries and issues like that. But before we maybe come back to that, we are going to dive deeper into the platform and the cryptos and all that with Jean-Charles.
Thank you very much, Hélène. I must say I feel like the casting error in this panel, because not only I didn't write a paper with Emmanuel, but also I'm a lonely microeconomist. But so I've decided I've decided to adopt this micro point of view. And I hope I will make remarks which I believe are quite different from the point of view you may have. And I hope you find that useful. So the first remark I will make, and it was motivated, in fact, by one of the beautiful sentences in one of Emmanuel's papers with Ivan. I quote, "One of the biggest risks in life is the family one is born into," which illustrates perfectly his preoccupation for and his permanent interest in redistributive taxation. So you may wonder, what's the connection between redistributive taxation and international capital markets? Well, I believe that in the recent years, there was a major improvement in tax collection following the adoption in the US of FATCA, you know, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, which forced foreign financial institutions to disclose information about the accounts of US persons, like they see in Switzerland, which are either residents or citizens. And this act, which was later imitated by several other big countries, allowed the US to collect something of the order of $10 billion in additional tax revenue. And my first remark is that if nothing is comparable is done for cryptocurrencies, then we are back to square one. That is, it will be very easy to evade the taxation by using cryptocurrency. So there is a lot of emphasis on the problem of the fragmentation of the payment system, on monetary sovereignty, but I believe there is also a problem in terms of tax collection. So if you deprive governments of money and taxes, there won't be much left, right? So this is my first remark. My second remark has to do with the industrial organization of the international payment system. Emmanuel, together with Hélène and Pierre-Olivier, have produced a few years ago a beautiful report on the reforms to the international monetary system, and I will not dare to make any remarks on this aspect, but I will take the point of view of the plumber, you know. I will look at the pipes, I will look at the industrial organization aspect. And if I'm not mistaken, the foreign exchange market is the biggest market in the world, with a daily turnover of more than $7 trillion US dollars, and spot transactions representing roughly one third of this figure. But why is it that this market is terribly inefficient? It's opaque, it's badly organized, and very costly to the final users. So cross-border transactions face many hurdles, including lack of harmonization of technical standards. Banks are forced to rely on their networks of correspondent banks, and which often charge hefty fees. So there is a fantastic opportunity. So I'm not 100% supporter of CBDC like Jean, but I would say, suppose that the larger central banks decide to cooperate and organize a network of interoperable CBDCs, then that could provide a safe, efficient, and fully accessible cross-currency fast payment system. So that would be a major change to the organization of foreign exchange market, and I believe a big improvement. I'm not 100% convinced that CBDCs are necessarily needed in advanced countries. at least the advanced countries that have already an efficient and accessible fast payment system, which is not the case in the US. But the rest of us seems to have already something very efficient for payments. And the advantage, one of the advantages of having CBDCs on top of the fast payment system would be precisely in improving the functioning of the cross-currency market, because central banks are needed for the cross-currency leg of the transaction. You can imagine cooperation between fast payment systems, and this already happens, but if it's in different currencies, you really need at some point a central bank, I believe. And finally, my third point is about the organization of domestic payment system and the development of stable coins and other forms of private digital currencies. What strikes me is this: this debate is that it's, nothing is new under the sun, or if I, like we say in English, plus ça change, plus c'est pareil, you see? So this discussion about private monies replicate exactly what happened in the US in the 19th century when the National Banking Act terminated the free banking era. And more recently, when there was this run on money market funds. So we are repeating exactly the same debate, the same questions. And if you look at, and there's a very good paper by Gorton and Zhang about this, a similarity between the private bank notes that circulate in the US during the free banking era. So there was a concern that those banknotes were not 100% backed by safe assets, and so there were runs. The system was very inefficient. There were a volatile exchange rate. They were traded under the par. And the National Banking Act precisely ended that by saying we're going to have a public banknote, so still issued by the banks, but requiring 100% backing in treasuries. And what happened was that the bank didn't find that profitable. They said it was too costly for them to do that, so they decided instead to encourage bank deposits. But the deposits were not insured at the time. So there were many runs, and so it's only the creation of the deposit insurance system in 1934 that ended the stuff. So are we going to go back to all these steps with the stable coins and, you know, why don't we learn from the past? So I believe that the development of private digital monies is, of course, largely due to the frenzy for new technologies, right? But also to some extent with the dissatisfaction with the inefficiency and lack of competition in the banking system. And Jean mentioned the credit card fees, but it's more general than that. So I believe public authorities see that a way to promote competition and innovation in payments is to encourage the entry of non-banks, that is, special entity payment service providers or narrow banks that do something else. They do not, you know, transform maturities, they are not subject to runs, but they are there to improve the quality of service for the users in the payment domain. So I believe this should be encouraged, but there is a requirement that the regulation, the regulators, really check that those so-called stable coins are really backed 100% by safe assets. So you may wonder, if you impose investing everything in safe assets, what's the value added? You know, because if the return on the safe assets is not higher than the interest paid on deposits, then who is going to make a profit of that? I believe there is a possibility to use the quality of the payment services, for example, the programmability of money or all kinds of innovations, in order to create value in the payment system itself, while strictly ensuring the stability of these new payment service providers. So I think I will stop here.
excellent, also superb intervention. So I cannot resist to giving the all the panelists so the freedom to reply, of course, to the other two. And or maybe to themselves. So also, if they feel like it, to answer the questions I asked about, whether we can see an unbundling in terms of international currencies because of the geopolitical situation, and maybe if anyone wants to, besides, so Jean-Charles, on the value added of these new entities, so fully with you. So. I have a quick question for you on that, and if others can add, if they see any value added in these business models, because it's very hard. Besides the two you mentioned, the quality of the payment system, and so, but the programmability, does it involve creating a new currency, or could it be done with a CBDC?
It could be done by the CBDC.
Therefore, we are back to square one. Why are we tolerating cryptocurrencies?
Well,
I mean, that's okay.
The payment system has always been a collaboration between the government and the private sector. And it's a public-private partnership. So if you look at the share of the public money versus private money, it has evolved across history. And so it's not clear to me that the government should be in charge of 100% of money. The government currently, the only connection between the government and us and the final users is essentially the cash, okay? So one way to go forward would be to say, let us replace cash by electronic cash, mm-hmm. which gives a lot of new functionalities.
But we do have electronic reserves.
Electronic reserves are for the banks, are not for the individuals.
Yes. So,
and so you don't want to completely perturb the balance between the private sector and the public sector, and that you want to limit, very much like currently cash transactions are limited. So maybe you could also limit electronic cash transactions, and that would be a sort of limited version of retail CBDC.
Right, but it depends how you structure your CBDC, indeed. If it's purely retail or not.
The devil is in the detail, absolutely. The design matters.
Absolutely, okay. So who wants to jump in here?
No, I just want to say I agree. I mean, we don't want the government to do all the details and the innovation, and many of the projects that exist anyway are going through banks, and the banks will be doing the job. I mean, that goes without saying.
Yeah, I think if I've seen like two arguments for why people are not rushing, for instance, to ban all of these forms of private money, one is the fact that there is something that the technology promises, the cryptography. It's no longer the digital ledger technology, now it's the cryptography that is promising. The programmability is in a very important part of it. So Jean was worried about whether this could lead to more tax evasion and so on. In some sense, if it's because of the programmability, you could actually make it harder to evade taxes. I mean, there's also that aspect to it. So there's a whole technology piece, which is that, you know, you don't want to kill a potential technology that might be very promising. And then the second thing is, there are all kinds of risky assets, risky forms of securities that go around the world, and you don't ban them, right? And so the question then is comparability of treatment, which is why now all the discussion is about we all need, we need to have some sort of global understanding about what exactly would Bitcoin be, what exactly would stablecoin be, and so on. And so we have definitional agreement, and then we treat like to like. So, if this is supposed to be truly money in the sense that it's fully backed, then we have to have regulation, make sure that that's indeed the case. If it is totally unbacked and it's just completely, a speculative asset, then you treat it like any other speculative asset. So I think that's the area in which there is, and indeed in terms of, what's the benefit of this at this point at least. I mean, of course, there's the technology promise, but in terms of the more immediate benefit, it is about cross-border transactions and about the payments. That without a doubt, that's incredibly inefficient, and so there is a space there when it comes to cross-border transactions for which the technology is valuable, as seen right now.
Thank you very much. So I'll just mention one thing. We might want to look at then the carbon content of some of those, which might be a reason already in itself for taxation. But now I'm going to open it to the audience for the last 10 minutes. Are there any questions that you would like to ask to our panelists? Don't be shy. Otherwise, I'm going to ask them to answer the geopolitical thing and the, the feasibility of a decoupling of a system of payments. But I can see that we have so here, and then Mike. Yeah.